If we think debates about privilege are complicated now, just wait until we can genetically engineer it. I mean, seriously, the day is coming when scientists will be able to offer prospective parents a whole raft of genetic improvements, basically to select for smarter, more beautiful babies. If that sounds like a terrible idea, let me introduce Oxford bioethicist Julian Savulescu. He thinks we actually have a moral obligation to use new technology to create the best possible children. Steve Paulson recently sat down with him to talk about hot-button issues like eugenics and human cloning.
Right now, there are serious research efforts to clone various animals, but cloning humans is off the table. I mean, that is considered just beyond the pale. Are you saying that's going to change?
Well, cloning of animals is routine in farming. Cloning in humans is used to produce stem cells, not embryos or fetuses or human beings, but stem cells for the treatment of disease. When it comes to cloning a human being, that also is completely possible now. You can split an early human embryo in two, into identical twins, deliberately. That's safe and reasonably efficient. You could freeze one of those identical twins, and you could implant it some years after the first, so you could have identical twins 10 years separated in age. So that technology is already there. It's not done because there's not clearly a need. There's not clearly a point to it.
Why would there be a need to do that? I mean, what circumstances could you foresee?
Well, I mean, for example, imagine that changing reproduction, women having children later and later, often not being able to have children even with IVF. Let's say you've got one embryo left. Let's say that last embryo was implanted and she was involved in a car accident and was about to lose the pregnancy from bleeding. And you could take a cell from that embryo and clone another embryo if that pregnancy was lost. That would be something that would be attractive to people if, you know, reproductive cloning was possible. It would give them the chance to have their own child. So one of the lessons of ethics is you can't make general pronouncements. Cloning is always unethical. It must be banned under all circumstances.
So you don't see any fundamental ethical objection to human cloning. It all depends on
the
circumstances.
Well, I mean, in reality, nobody does. Well, no, that's not true. A few people do. But you've got to remember that 1 in 300 pregnancies involve clones. Identical twins are clones. They are much more genetically related than a clone using the nuclear transfer technique where you take a skin cell from one individual and create a clone from the other.
But that's not something that we engineer. That just happened, right?
Well, again, one of the big mistakes in ethics is to think that means make all the difference. But the fact that we've done it or nature has done it is irrelevant to the individuals. So if it turned out that, say, you know, Jim and John, a couple of identical twins, say they'd arisen not through the natural splitting of an embryo, but because some embryologist, some IVF doctor, had divided the embryo at the third day after conception. What difference would it make? And the fact that they arose through choice and not chance is, in my view, morally irrelevant.
So this whole idea that, you know, we could, in a sense, play God, tamper with the laws of nature and create things that wouldn't exist otherwise, that's a red herring to you.
Well, we're playing God every day. I mean, you know, we play God when we vaccinate. We play God when we give, you know, women pain relief during labor. And of course, the challenge is to decide how to change the course of nature, not whether to change the course of nature.
Now, you have said that parents actually have an ethical responsibility to select the best children they can have using whatever technology might be available. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, there are many things that we can do which will affect the start that our children have in life in terms of the genes that they've inherited. Genetic technology enables the testing of embryos and the production of more than one embryo. And in my view, we should use those tests to look for genes which are correlated with greater advantages or opportunities in life. So one which is often discussed is being hearing or deaf. or having higher intelligence or greater aptitude at school or less. Now, my argument is that we ought to select children who have better opportunities or better lives. Now, most people accept that when it comes to diseases. Say, well, you know, that's fine to choose a healthy embryo rather than one with a catastrophic disease. But many people draw the line at disease. They say, well, once you get into the healthy range, then we shouldn't be playing God. We shouldn't be interfering in nature.
Right, because, I mean, this raises the specter of, you know, with tinkering with the genes, you could essentially buy or create smarter, stronger, more beautiful children.
Indeed, you could. And in my view, to the degree that those characteristics have an effect on how happy and how well a person's life goes, we should choose those genes. For example, 10% of kids today are on Ritalin for attention deficit disorder. And that's not because there's been some epidemic of attention deficit disorder. It's because if you have poor impulse control, if you can't concentrate long enough, if you can't defer small rewards now for large rewards in the future, you're crippled as a human being. You're crippled because you can't make plans for the long term, whatever you want to do, whether you want to be a plumber, a taxi driver, a lawyer, or the president. Now, if you were able to test for very poor impulse control in embryos and identify those that were going to start off life with that significant, what I believe is disability, I believe we should select ones that are going to have a better chance of having a wider range of choices in life and much higher chances of success, whatever they want to do.
Okay, but it's one thing to talk about controlling impulse control. It's another to talk about trying to enhance the smarts, the intelligence of a baby. I mean, basically cognitive enhancement through genetic engineering.
Well, it does raise another level of ethical concerns, but I think the question we always have to ask and reflect, you know, what should we do? Education is a cognitive enhancer. Computers and the internet are cognitive enhancers. We give children food supplements and better diets to enhance cognitive ability. So if we can do that through a genetic mechanism, why should we treat that differently to, say, a dietary supplement or some external technology like computing or the internet? The only difference between giving a vitamin and giving gene therapy is risky, really risky. And that's why we don't do it. But if it becomes safe, and if science gives us the opportunity of improving those people's lives, I think we should use it.
Hmm. What about the specter of eugenics, of creating superior groups of people? This doesn't worry you?
Many people are concerned about eugenics, and they remember the Nazi program of sterilization and then extermination of people deemed to be unfit. Their targets were people with intellectual disability, mental illness, and criminality. Now, it's important to recognize this wasn't a program that was unique to Nazi Germany. The extermination part was, but the sterilization, the prevention of reproduction was common through Europe and the United States. Many states in the United States had eugenics laws that enabled people who were intellectually disabled or mentally ill to be sterilized against their will. So this kind of eugenics was one of the darker sides of the 20th century. But eugenics itself literally just means well-born. It means having a child who is better in some way. Now, eugenics is alive and well today. When people screen their pregnancies for Down syndrome or intellectual disability, that's eugenics.
Because the reason to do that would be you would abort the fetus if you find that your fetus does have Down syndrome.
Exactly. If you were to give, you know, a therapy that cured Down syndrome or disposition to mental illness at either the embryonic, fetal or infant level, that would be a kind of eugenics. What was wrong with Nazi eugenics was it was involuntary. People had no choice, whereas people have a choice today. Secondly, it was racist and it was aimed at creating a certain kind of society. It was what's called social Darwinism. Today, eugenics is about giving couples a choice about having a child who will have a better or worse life for themselves. So it is a eugenics program, but it's sometimes called liberal eugenics. So the idea that making choices for the next generation is always Nazi eugenics is a deep mistake.
Now, we've talked a fair amount about some of the ethics involving reproduction and new reproductive technology. What about dying? Do we need to rethink the ethics of when it's okay for people to die?
Well, I think dying is, again, something that matters to people a lot. And there's two aspects that we'll have to confront. One, if we're already confronting, that is, what control should we have about when and how we die? And I think ethically, that's an uninteresting topic. You know, of course, people should be allowed to decide, you know, when and how they exit this world.
So you have no problems with euthanasia?
Well, I mean, I have problems with how it might be implemented. But in principle, if I want to end my life and someone else wants to help me, what business is it of the state or other people to interfere in that?
Okay, so you said that that's the uninteresting question about death. What's the interesting one?
Oh, the interesting question is how long we should live. If we could attack aging, which is actually the real disease that causes, you know, adult onset cancer and cardiovascular disease, stroke and diabetes and these sorts of diseases, if we could turn off aging, people could live healthily, maybe for 200 years, maybe longer. So I think that you will find over the next 20 or 30 years the possibility of radically extending human life. And then we'll face the deep question, how long should we live? How many people should there be? How should we change work? How will we pay for people living to 150? How will younger people carve out a place in society? So these, I think, are really deep and difficult questions. Will life become boring? Is this something that people should have a choice over, or should we place termination criteria on how long people should? So again, rather than us dying through just what happens to us naturally, it may be that our death starts to become not just our choice, which is the euthanasia debate, but society's choice.
Right. But, I mean, there are obvious questions about overpopulation. I mean, can the Earth handle, you know, all those people and questions of environmental degradation? And as you say, how do the younger people coming up fit into all of this if their elders never leave the scene?
I mean, is it better to have, you know, a society with 1 billion people or, you know, 500 million people, say the US, living to 80? Or is it better to have 250 million people living to 160? Those are difficult questions that we may well have the power to ask. It'll be us that'll have to decide. The exciting period now is we have to make decisions. And this idea that, you know, well, we'll just leave it to the market to resolve it, I think is not going to continue to wash.
Julian Savulescu is a moral philosopher at the University of Oxford. And by the way, Steve did a longer interview with him, which ran in Nautilus magazine recently. If you'd like to read it, you can find a link on our website at ttbook.org.